Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Storm in Paradise Valley by Charles G. West. Narrated by Mort Shelby. With performances by Michael Glenn, Danny Gavigan, Christopher Sheeran, Kimberly Gilbert, Thomas Keegan, Tim Getman, David Harris, Michael John Casey, Eric Mesner, Dylan Lynch, David Coyne, Lily Beacon, Drew Copas, Evan Casey, James Lewis, Tim Carlin, Bradley Smith, Christopher Graybill, Nick DePinto, Stephen Carpenter, Terrence Aselford, Richard Cutting, Mort Shelby, Richard Rowan, Scott McCormick, Rose Elizabeth Supan, Nanette Savard, Ken Jackson, and Colleen Delaney. Lucinda Tate paused when something caught her eye as she was leaning over the edge of the well. She straightened and casually brushed a strand of gray hair from her forehead, gazing toward the dusty lane that led from the road to the house. She couldn't control the feeling of despair that swept over her entire soul, though she was not surprised by what she saw. It was something she'd dreaded since Billy first entered his teens, a moment destined to come to pass. She turned to call her husband, who was on the back porch mending a harness.
Pa! Billy's home!
She pulled the bucket full of water up and left it on the side of the well, unconsciously drying her hands on her apron. She walked out to meet the rider. By now, John Tate had walked through the house to the front porch. Like his wife, he paused when he saw the rider on the buckskin horse making his way up the lane. The formidable figure in the saddle was easy to recognize and one that John expected, though with heartfelt dread. The horse the deputy marshal led was also easy to recognize. It was Billy's Sorrel, and the body draped across the saddle was testament to his son's destined homecoming. He descended the steps to join his wife in the yard. She took hold of his arm for support, though there were no tears yet. This day had been promised for too long. It was a sorrowful task for Jason Storm, but one he felt obligated to perform. The Tates were good people, but like a lot of good folks, they were burdened with a prodigal son. Ordinarily, the family of a deceased outlaw had to claim the body at the undertaker's, but because of the empathy he felt for the boy's parents, Jason spared them the humiliation of carting their son's corpse through the town.
Mr. Tate, ma'am, I brought Billy's body home. He didn't give me no choice when I tried to arrest him. I'm sorry.
John Tate stepped up to take the reins from Jason's hand.
I can help you carry him.
I can take care of him. I ain't got no hard feelings agin you, Mr. Storm. You're a fair man. I know Billy didn't give you no choice. When he left here after killing that man in the bank, he swore that if you found him, one of you was gonna be dead. It ain't your fault.
Yes, sir. But I'm sorry it had to happen.
Jason pulled the buckskin's head around as Billy's mother turned away to hide the tears she could no longer hold back. Holding his horse to an easy lope, he rode back down the lane, leaving the grieving parents to take care of their dead son. He was not concerned with the thought of an angry father taking a shot at his broad back as he rode away. He trusted John Tate when the man said he held them blameless. It was just a damn shame good people got cursed with bad seeds like Billy Tate. It was all senseless. Just another young hothead, liquored up and thinking his pistol was the answer to anything that displeased him. Eager to throw in with Slate Hatcher, a criminal promising easy money if Billy wanted to use his gun.
I'm tired of it. 25 years of bringing bodies back. I'm damn sick and tired of it.
Jason Storm was a big man, but he didn't look that big until you stood next to him and he gazed down at you with an expression that conveyed his impatience with what you were about to say when you hadn't even said it yet. Rawhide tough, he walked with a quiet, purposeful stride reminiscent of a panther on the prowl, whether it be in a saloon for an evening drink or to face down a cornered cattle rustler. He had no close friends that anybody knew about, but there were few folks in this part of the territory who didn't know Deputy Marshal Jason Storm. No one knew Jason's age, but if you were here when the town was born, you'd know that Jason Storm had ridden this part of Wyoming territory for more than 25 years, and was the main reason this part of the territory lived peaceful for the most part. He never seemed to age, looking the same year after year, riding a buckskin named Biscuit. Hank Brumby, who owned the Red Rooster Saloon, joked that Jason must have sworn in when he was 10 years old. Folks who lived in town at least 6 years knew that Jason had once been married. Cheerful and gracious to a fault, Mary Ellen Storm had been a sharp contrast to her husband's granite-like somberness. Doc Shaw said Mary had a weak heart, and she succumbed to a bout of pneumonia that most likely would not have killed her had she been stronger. Jason retreated within himself to mourn her, but he reported to work 2 days after her funeral to run Rafe Slater to ground. None had the nerve to ask Jason why he returned so soon after laying Mary to rest. But if they had, and Jason saw fit to answer, they probably would have heard that it was his job to arrest cold-blooded murderers such as Rafe Slater, even when it was necessary to follow him up into Montana territory where he held no jurisdiction. It was a comforting feeling for the people of Mission Valley to know that Jason Storm was on the job. Now, on this chilly day in early spring 1878, they would have been concerned to know the thoughts lying heavy on Jason's mind. Marshal Jim Masters glanced up from his desk to find Jason Storm standing in the doorway.
Jason? Come in, man. I didn't expect to see you back this soon.
He leaned back in his chair.
Any luck running Slate Hatcher to ground?
He knew the answer before asking the question. Jason ambled into the office and eased himself into a chair.
Oh, I took Billy Tate's body back home to his folks. I just got back with Slate Hatcher's body.
He dropped the canvas bank bag on the marshal's desk.
There's the bank's money. I don't know how much or if all of it's there or not.
Masters nodded, then frowned.
Yeah, too bad about that boy Billy. But hell, he's been bound and determined to get himself killed for quite a while. Hatcher should have been killed a long time ago. Ain't nobody gonna miss him. You did a good job. Did what you had to do. Why don't you take a few days off and go hunting or fishing? Everything seems peaceful enough right now. The judge has a couple of subpoenas to serve, but one of the younger boys can do that.
Well, that's what I came to tell you. I'm taking off for good, Jim. I've had enough.
While Master's jaw dropped in disbelief, Jason slowly reached up and removed his badge. He took one long look at it, then laid it on the desk. Masters drew away from it as if it were a snake.
You can't be serious.
Jason Storm was the epitome of law enforcement in Wyoming Territory. Masters assumed the stoic lawman would always be the swift sword of justice that kept this part of the territory from becoming another Badlands.
You just need to take a little vacation. I expect I've been riding you a little too hard during the last couple of months.
Nah, that ain't it. It's just time to quit this business. 25 years is long enough. I want to quit while I'm still fit and I got time to move on to something besides sitting around some saloon talking about the old days.
Masters pushed his chair back from the desk as if he needed more room to absorb the startling resignation, still hoping that Jason's announcement was merely a spur-of-the-moment decision.
You're a hell of a ways from sitting around a saloon. Besides, all you know is the law. What do you figure to do? Farm? Hell, you don't know nothing about farming.
I expect you're right about that. I don't know much about farming. I might raise a garden, but that's about all. I'm thinking more about raising a few head of cattle and some horses, maybe. Build me something a little more substantial than a one-room cabin. I saved back a little money over the years, enough to get me started, and I'm thinking about a little valley up Montana way I saw when I finally ran Rafe Slater to the ground right after Mary died. And most of that land up there was open to whoever claimed it, so I reckon I'll find out whether I waited too long to do something about it.
The longer they talked, the more Masters realized there was no chance of changing Jason's mind. So he resigned himself to losing the territory's best deputy. When Jason got up to leave, Masters rose as well and came around his desk to walk him to the door. A simple handshake was all Jason required to close this chapter of his life. Masters, however, was moved to say one final thing.
I don't reckon I have to tell you that you're welcome back anytime you change your mind.
I appreciate it, Jim.
Jason turned and left. Masters stood in the doorway, gazing at the broad back of the man who looked to be in the prime of his life instead of like a man ready to retire. He remained there until Jason disappeared.
Damn.
He returned to his desk, wondering how in hell he was going to replace Jason Storm.
God damn.
It had been 5 years since he'd crossed these grass-covered hills, but Jason remembered the cuts and valleys that made tracking Rafe Slater such a tedious job. The thought struck him at the time that it was a country isolated enough to let a man escape the bother associated with the civilized world. It was a part of the country where he was not known. That fact gave him a sense of peace. The thing that troubled him on this day, however, was the occasional sign of civilization he now encountered every few miles as he followed the river north. 5 years ago, Indians lived in many parts of this valley. Now, they appeared to have been replaced by white settlers, judging by the cultivated plots he saw along the river. That stirred up conflicting thoughts. On the one hand, he wanted solitude. On the other, his practical sense told him that unless he planned to survive solely by hunting and trapping, he needed other folks for supplies, as well as for seed stock for cattle. He continued along the valley floor, following the river north, leading one pack horse with all his earthly possessions, growing more and more concerned by the frequency of fields and homesteads he passed.
Oh, damn. Where'd all these people come from?
Finally, where the river took a sharp bend, he came upon a sawmill, and in a short distance he saw the town he had already surmised was bound to be there.
Well, we might as well see what's what before moving on.
Guiding Biscuit up the riverbank, he struck a road that led into town. The town was built along one side of the river, a few buildings in a line facing the river, with the road leading straight into town and out the other end. None of the structures were very old. Some were still under construction, which was not surprising since there had been no trace of the town when Jason last rode through the valley 5 years before.
Must have popped up overnight like a crop of toadstools.
Jason approached the first building. It appeared to be a saloon, the sign over which read simply, Thompson. Down three steps along the wooden walkway, there was another building. A roughly lettered sign nailed up over a pair of double doors proclaimed that establishment to be Paradise General Store. Between the general store and a livery stable, a blacksmith had set up shop. On the other side of the stable, a small combination barber shop and dentist office sat next door to the sheriff's office. A wide alley separated the sheriff's office from what looked to be the combination residence and office of a doctor.
Not much of a town.
Jason guided his horses toward the general store.
Well, I guess it's about as good a start for one as any.
He was surprised to see the town already boasted a sheriff, however. He guessed that position must be a part-time job. The town hardly looked big enough to warrant paying a full-time lawman, that was for sure.
Good day.
Inside the store, he was greeted by Fred Hatfield, the proprietor. Bone-thin, middle-aged man who was busy dusting the merchandise on the amply filled shelves.
Afternoon. I'm needing a few things if you got them.
New in town?
No, passing through.
Jason touched his hat brim politely when Lena Hatfield came from behind the counter.
Last time I was through this valley, this town wasn't here. It was about 5 years ago.
That was about 1 year before I built this store. It didn't take long for other folks to find this valley after the engines cleared out. Good water, good grass, good land for crops.
Yeah, I noticed a few homesteads on my way in from the south. Maybe I'm a little too late. I had in mind to cut out a little piece of this valley for myself.
Oh? Well, we're always ready to welcome new folks into the valley, and there's plenty of land that ain't been settled north of the town. Mr. Pryor owns the whole valley and has options on most of the valley beyond this one. But he's mighty reasonable to anybody that's looking to settle here.
Have you got your family with you?
No, ma'am. I'm all the family I got.
Oh.
From Lena's expression, Jason guessed that she figured him for just another drifter passing through.
I'm figuring on finding a place where I can raise a few head of cattle. Maybe enough of a garden to keep me from having to live on nothing but meat.
You might find what you're looking for up on the north end of the valley.
It's pretty country. Plenty of water and grass, but the lay of it is too hilly for most folks who want to cultivate farms. Might be just what you're looking for. Of course, it ain't too convenient to town.
Now, that last part just makes it more interesting to me. I'll go have a look up that way.
Good. Hope you find what you're looking for.
Hatfield glanced at his wife briefly before looking back to Jason.
When you first came in, me and the missus figured you might be one of Pryor's boys that we hadn't seen yet.
Well, who's Pryor?
Raymond Pryor is what you might call my business partner. He owns the saloon with Ben Thompson and a piece of almost everybody else's business, so he kind of runs the town. He's helped almost every one of us get our businesses started up. He doesn't try to tell you how to run your business. He ain't interested in that. Just wants the town to grow and be successful. Ben Thompson runs the saloon next door. Like me, he couldn't make it without Mr. Pryor's help. But Pryor's more interested in cattle. He has a sizable crew that works his cattle ranch and takes care of anything else that needs fixing around town. If you're planning to ride up the valley, you'll be passing through Pryor's range. Might be a good idea to let him know what you've got on your mind. Chances are he'll offer to help. He's planning on making a real town out of Paradise, and he's glad to see new folks moving in.
Well, much obliged. Looks like maybe the right place to light. So I need a few things like coffee and flour, salt, and maybe some sugar.
Yes, sir.
Hatfield hurried around behind the counter. Before he started scooping coffee beans onto the scale, he paused to extend his hand.
My name's Fred Hatfield.
He didn't think to introduce Lena.
Jason Storm.
Jason watched Hatfield scoop beans into the scale and felt a bit surprised that the store seemed so well stocked.
Must be kind of hard getting supplies this far off in the mountains.
It would be, I reckon, if Mr. Pryor hadn't made an arrangement with some folks over in Helena to freight in whatever we need.
Hatfield paused to stroke his chin, thinking.
Jason Storm. Sounds familiar, but I can't say why.
He gave it a few more moments' thought, then turned his attention back to business.
Now, it's just a common name, I reckon.
After taking leave of Fred and Lena Hatfield, Jason decided it had been a while since he'd had a drink of whiskey. He saw one man seated at one of the tables eating an early supper, the bartender, Gus Hopkins.
Howdy.
He squinted against the sunlight behind Jason in an effort to identify his customer. He got to his feet and started toward the bar when he realized he didn't know the man.
Just trying to get a little supper up before the evening crowd starts drifting in. What can I do for you?
Jason couldn't help but wonder where the hell the crowd would come from. There didn't seem to be more than two or three people on the street. He noticed a sign on the wall behind the bar that advertised the price of sour mash whiskey at two bits a shot.
Have a shot of that sour mash.
He put his money on the bar and watched as Gus poured the shot glass full.
There you are.
Oh, damn. That sure as hell ain't watered down. Where I come from, a good shot of whiskey is 50 cents. I expected it to cost more than that in a place this far from a city.
You can thank Mr. Pryor for that. He's as fair a man as you'll ever meet, and he set on attracting good folks to paradise.
Well, maybe I will if I ever run into him. Two bits a shot, I reckon I can afford another one.
Gus filled the glass.
I don't reckon you'd be a preacher by any chance, would you?
Oh, hardly.
Well, just thought I'd ask. Mr. Pryor is set on getting a preacher here. He figures building a church would bring in more settlers.
Oh, I expect it might. Oh.
Plan on staying or just passing through?
Jason repeated his intentions.
Well, you know, Fred's right. There's a lot of good grazing land on the other end of Mr. Pryor's spread. Better for horses and cattle than farming.
He offered his hand.
Gus Hopkins, welcome to paradise.
Jason Storm.
Jason was becoming convinced that the fledgling town just might in fact be properly named. It sure seemed that Mr. Raymond Pryor was intent upon making it so.
Well, Biscuit, looks like nice country. Folks seem nice, but we still don't want to live too close to it.
The horse pushed on without comment. Jason didn't have to ride far to see that what Hatfield told him was true. There were no homesteads beyond about half a mile north of the town, and it was almost a half day farther and close to dark when he came upon a simple frame house sitting close by the river with a barn and what appeared to be a bunkhouse beyond. After hearing about Raymond Pryor in town, he half expected to find a large gate with a fancy sign overhead announcing the entrance to a palatial ranch house. The modest Pryor home served to impress him with the man's obvious values. Guiding Biscuit toward the house, Jason looked the ordinary structure over. There was no smoke from the chimney, and the windows were dark except for a light in the kitchen. It appeared there was no one at home. The thought occurred to him then that farther on there might still be the mansion he expected and that he had been mistaken in his assumption. He proceeded on to the bunkhouse, where there were signs of plenty that someone was home. As Jason stepped inside the noisy room, he found that he had arrived right at supper time. There were seven men seated around a long table where a cook stood serving up a hot meal.
Hello.
All eyes turned to Jason.
I'm looking to find Mr. Pryor's house.
A large man with no hair on his head save a sparse patch around the back and over his ears turned to look Jason over.
I expect you just passed it before you got here. That is, if you came from town.
Since the man was seated at the head of the table, Jason decided he must be the foreman.
Well, I'd be obliged if you could tell me where I might find Mr. Pryor.
The bald man cocked his head.
You found him?
Jason nodded, as if considering this for a moment.
Well, oh, since I busted in just when you was eating your supper, I reckon I can wait till you finished.
Hell, I ain't, Mr. Pryor.
He nodded toward a thin little man with a shock of thick gray hair seated on his left.
He's Mr. Pryor. I'm Curly Yates.
Pryor put down his fork.
You want to see me? What about? Are you looking for a job?
Oh, nope. Well, they told me in town that you own most of the land in this valley and the next. So I reckon I'm just curious about what you'd sell a little bit of it for.
Well, come on in and sit down. Have some supper. Slide over, Grady, and let the man sit down.
Pryor glanced back up at Jason.
That is, if you'd care to eat.
Well, I've never been one to turn down a hot meal.
Jason climbed over the bench to seat himself across from Pryor.
Otis, bring our guest a plate and some weapons.
Pryor turned his attention back to Jason.
Now, Mr.
Storm.
Mr. Storm, what have you got in mind? You don't look much like a farmer to me. You have a wife and family?
No family.
Otis placed a plate of food, utensils, and a cup of coffee before Jason.
Just me. My wife passed away a few years back, and you're right, I ain't a farmer. Tell you the truth, I rode through this valley about 5 years ago, and there wasn't nobody here. So I sort of set it in my mind to come back and fix up a little place to raise some stock of my own. Well, I still like the look of it, and if you're a reasonable man, I was hoping I might be able to buy a small piece from you. To tell you the truth, I wasn't expecting the land to be surveyed and folks already settling here, so I didn't figure on having to pay anything for it. So if the price is too steep, well, I'll just keep on riding up through Montana until I find some place I like as well as this.
Pryor paid strict attention to Jason's every word, and Jason got the feeling the man was trying to plumb the depth of his character.
Well, you're pretty straightforward in what your needs are. Is your name on any wanted posters anywhere?
Nope. I'm not wanted for any crimes. But I'd have to be a damn fool to tell you if I was.
I guess you would at that. The boys here can tell you that what I aim to do is build a town where decent folks can be proud to live. Naturally, I'd like to see families move in, but I don't have anything against a hard-working bachelor if he contributes to the welfare of the community.
Pryor hesitated when he read a hint of concern in Jason's face.
Maybe that's not what you're looking for.
Well, I tell you, Mr. Pryor, I don't intend to be any trouble for anybody, but I'm not looking to be a big part of the town's affairs. I'm looking for a place where I can mind my own business, where I ain't too far from the mountains and the prairies. It doesn't have to be much as long as there's water and grass and a few head of cattle and some horses.
Blind Woman Creek.
Pryor nodded agreement with Curly Yates' suggestion.
Yeah, maybe so. Yeah, that might be what you're looking for, all right. That's land up a canyon that we aren't using. And if it suits you, then we'll talk about the price. Curly can ride up there with you in the morning, and you can tell me what you think tomorrow. Fair enough?
Fair enough.
Good. You can bunk here tonight, if you can stand the company. There's a couple of empty bunks at the back.
I'm much obliged. I ain't slept under a roof in a while.
The next morning after breakfast, Jason waited while Curly assigned the day's chores to his men. Then Curly and Jason rode out to the north, following the general course of the river. Curly set a leisurely pace toward the mountains that appeared to box the valley at the upper end. Jason remembered, however, that there was a narrow pass that led to a second valley beyond. As they rode, Curly talked about the man he worked for and what he planned to do.
Mr. Pryor's a good man, and a damn generous one at that. He hired me and the boys in Cheyenne. We brought a herd up from Texas and was fixing to ride back. But he made us an offer to come help him start up this place. He don't know much about raising cattle, so he pretty much leaves that to me. What he's good at is building a town. And before he's through, Paradise is going to be a proper city with a church and school. If me or any of the men decide to settle down and raise a family, he says he'll see to it that we have a place of our own with a house on it.
Well, that's mighty generous, all right. All that he's doing takes a hell of a lot of money.
Ain't no doubt about that. Folks say he made his money in the banking business, and he owned a newspaper back east somewhere. Part of my job is to make sure nobody gets no ideas about Mr. Pryor's money.
I see. Is there a Mrs. Pryor?
No. He's like you, ain't got no family. With all his money, he ain't a fancy man himself either. Lives in that plain little house with a Mexican couple that takes care of the place. The woman, Juanita, cooks, but Mr. Pryor takes most of his meals with the men down at the bunkhouse.
It was almost noon when Curly stopped talking about Raymond Pryor and pulled up beside a small creek that emptied into the river at a sharp bend in the river's course.
Blind Woman Creek. You follow the creek back through that little gulch there, it'll lead you to the other side of the ridge yonder. That land on the other side of the ridge is the piece Mr. Pryor's talking about.
Jason stood up in the stirrups and gazed all around him for a few minutes before settling in the saddle again. Turning Biscuit's head then, he followed the creek back up through the gulch toward the ridge. Curly followed along behind him. On the far side of the ridge, they found themselves facing a wide expanse of grassy prairie that gradually ascended toward the mountain beyond. Jason knew instantly he had found his place. He could feel it touch his soul. There was no further decision to be made as far as he was concerned, depending upon Pryor's largesse. They spent an additional hour while Jason looked the land over, fixing in his mind where he would build his cabin, where he'd build his barn and corral. He could already see the finished product in his mind. When they returned to Pryor's place, Curly joined his boss on the porch.
Well, what do you think?
Far as I can tell, he appears to be all right. He don't talk a hell of a lot, so I can't really tell you much about where he came from or what he's been doing. But I just get a gut feeling that he's an honest man. He was looking that land over like he was already laying it out in his mind.
Ah, I like that. Sounds like he's planning to build something instead of just squatting on the land. Come on, we'll go talk to him.
Pryor walked over to the corral, where he found Jason inspecting the shoes on his pack horse.
Got a problem?
No, sir. Just checking. She's bad about throwing a shoe once in a while, but she seems to be all right.
Well, what did you think about that piece up at Blind Woman Creek? Think it might be suitable for what you've got in mind?
Yes, sir. I expect it might work out just fine, depending on whether I can afford it or not.
Pryor studied Jason's face for a full minute before making his proposition.
I'll tell you what I'll do. That piece from the river back to the mountain has about 150 acres of good grazing land. I'll sell it to you for $1 an acre. Now, if you'll keep an eye on any of my stock that wanders too far over that way, I'll wait a year before we have to settle up, and I'll help you with some breed stock to boot.
Jason was surprised. Pryor was a generous man.
I reckon we got a deal.
They shook on it. Jason knew he'd found the place he had hoped for.
I was fixing to ask you about buying some calves from you.
We'll work something out. Now, come on. Let's go to supper, neighbor.
The next few weeks were filled with long days of hard work. Jason, still amazed by Pryor's generosity, labored from dawn to dusk to build a corral and a small cabin on the eastern side of the ridge that stood close to the river. Locating his cabin beside Blind Woman Creek, he had an uncluttered view of the mountain and the gentle grassy apron surrounding its base. There was plenty of timber available on the mountain, and the task of snaking it down to the creek became considerably easier when Curly brought a couple of his men and a pair of mules to speed up the construction. Pryor himself checked on Jason's progress from time to time, always offering praise and encouragement for Jason's obvious work ethic.
You're a hard-working man, Jason Storm. Looks like you weren't joshing when you said you planned to build a real homestead here.
Pryor reached out to take the cup of coffee Jason offered. He looked Jason directly in the eye.
You know, I make quite a few trips a year to Helena and occasionally to Butte. I hear a lot of things that folks in this valley don't. Jason Storm. I heard of a United States Deputy Marshal over in Wyoming territory by that name. Had a hell of a reputation as a lawman, according to what I heard.
Jason met Pryor's gaze without any apparent reaction.
Oh, he quit the marshaling business, is what I heard. Got tired of the killing and chasing no-account lawbreakers. Left Wyoming to find some place where folks didn't know him, hoping to find a little peace.
Pryor paused to give that some thought. In his mind, he pictured Oscar Perkins, the farmer who took the part-time job as sheriff of his little town. Oscar was a poor comparison to the broad-shouldered, rock-hard man kneeling by this campfire. It was awfully tempting to try to persuade Jason to take over the law enforcement of Paradise, but he resisted.
Fair enough. A man's past is his own business as long as it doesn't hurt anyone else.
I appreciate it.
Subject never came up again. By the middle of the summer, Jason had a dried-in cabin, a corral, and a shed for a barn. It was time to think about laying in a supply of firewood for the winter, but before taking that on, he figured he had earned a day off to go hunting. He knew he'd be doing a lot of hunting in the fall for meat to dry, but this trip was simply for the joy of rewarding himself with a feast of roast venison. Biscuit, equally eager for a holiday, exhibited no objections to the saddle, even though he'd not been burdened with it over the past few weeks. Stepping up in the stirrup, Jason paused to take a look at his little piece of paradise. Satisfied that he had landed in a good spot and an enviable situation, he relaxed his hold on the reins and let the buckskin set the pace, confident that he had found the peace he had craved since Mary Ellen's death. The crystal blue sky and the lazy wheeling of a hawk high overhead brought him a feeling of deep contentment. All was well in his world as he loped off across the slope, unaware of the evil tempest about to descend upon the sleepy little settlement of Paradise.
Rider's coming.
Bob Dawson climbed up on top of a flat rock to get a better look. After a minute or so, when the riders were closer, he recognized them.
It's Doc and Lacey.
He climbed down from the rock and walked back to the fire, where three men sat in bored anticipation. None of the three seemed interested enough to reply to Dawson's report as he picked up the coffee pot and helped himself to a cup. Then Dawson made himself comfortable against the trunk of a cottonwood and waited with the others. In a few minutes' time, the two riders loped past the flat rock and pulled up in the trees where the horses were tied. As Dawson had, they headed for the coffee pot after dismounting. Mace Cantrell eyed the new arrivals.
Well, what'd you find?
Doc looked up from his coffee.
Not much. There ain't no bank. Me and Lacey rode into town and rode out the other end before we knowed it. Didn't we, Lacey?
That's about right. There ain't much there. They got a saloon, though.
Junior watched Lacey wrap his bandana around the metal handle of the coffee pot to keep from burning his hand.
We sure could use one of them.
The general store, stable, blacksmith, doctor's office, a dentist, sawmill, and the saloon. That's about it, except for a couple of houses. There's a sheriff's office, but we didn't see nobody around. No telegraph lines.
Lacey paused to pour his coffee, only to discover an empty pot.
Damn it! Who's the lazy son of a bitch that set an empty pot back on the fire?
Zeke Cheney gave Bob Dawson a wink.
We was all waiting for you to get back. We know you're better than anybody at grinding the beans.
Mace Cantrell stared at the stick he'd been absent-mindedly fiddling with. Then he threw it into the fire, registering his disgust with the report on the town.
Well, I reckon a body couldn't expect much of a town way the hell out here 50 miles from the nearest railroad.
Doc stretched.
Might as well saddle up and head on out for Belfouge like we planned.
Maybe, but I might have changed my mind. A drink of liquor would go pretty good right now.
Cantrell picked up another dead branch and poked around in the fire with it while he thought it over.
Well, right on in. Might as well have a drink and look the place over. Doc and Lacey might have missed something.
You're the boss. Of course, I wouldn't likely argue again a drink of liquor anyway.
Mace Cantrell was the boss. There was no question about that fact among the ruthless gang of six men. Tall and lean as a fence post, he was as deadly as a serpent, with black hair and a week's growth of jet black whiskers. His dark, lifeless eyes, set deep beneath heavy brows, were said to have been the last image more than a dozen men had glimpsed before going to hell. Acting as his second, Doc, his older brother by 2 years, was always at his side for the remote possibility that Mace's authority might be challenged. On this day in early July, Mace's gang of unprincipled backshooters and bushwhackers had run a little ragged, causing Mace to fall into one of his frequent dark moods. Even Doc spoke little to his brother when he fell into one of these black depressions. Things had not gone well for him in Virginia City. The town had grown large enough to deal with their kind, and they fled the territory after a foiled bank robbery, only to find Butte and Helena alerted to watch out for him. There was the matter of a slain bank guard, so Mace decided it best to head to the north, away from the main trails, planning to eventually wind up back east in the Dakota Territory. From what Doc and Lacey reported, the little town of Paradise seemed unlikely to offer any threat to them. Doc said there were no telegraph lines, so it was doubtful there was any communication with the larger towns.
Hell of a place for a town. We'll ride in and get us a drink in the morning.
Mace Cantrell got up and walked off into the trees to be alone with his thoughts. Always concerned, his brother Doc watched him until he disappeared beyond the brow of the hill. Zeke Cheney shook his head once Mace had passed out of earshot.
Hell, what's wrong with going to get a drink tonight?
Doc Cantrell cast a warning frown in Zeke's direction.
Well, why don't you just go tell him you don't want to wait till morning, huh?
I'm just saying, that's all.
Though the most recent recruit to the small band of outlaws, Cheney had learned not to question an order from Mace Cantrell. A nagging toothache did not serve to improve the gang leader's somber disposition as he considered the report Lacey and Doc had brought back. He had seen better days. That, there was no doubt. The last few years of raiding and running had him longing for the old days, riding with Quantrill and Anderson. He tended to lay most of the blame for his recent hard times on the collection of saddle tramps that now made up his raiding party. Only his brother Doc had been with him during the war. The other four were down and outers he picked up along the way. He would have traded the lot of them for just one of the men who rode with him during the war. He was 20 years of age when he and Doc joined Bill Quantrill's raiders. They raided and fought the abolitionists in Missouri and Kansas, siding with the Confederates as they slaughtered soldiers and civilians alike. And when the outfit became too big for even Quantrill to effectively command, Mace and Doc broke off with Bill Anderson to form a separate guerrilla force. Bloody Bill Anderson made a name for himself, feared as much as Quantrill's, and young Mace Cantrell proved a dedicated disciple. He soon became one of Bill's lieutenants and rode with him on that fateful day in October 1864, when they were lured into a trap set for him by Union soldiers in Ray County, Missouri. Mace and Doc were among the few who escaped, leaving Bloody Bill shot full of holes behind him. Mace formed his own gang from the survivors of the ambush, moving farther west after the war to continue raids on banks and trains, employing the same tactics he learned from Quantrill and Anderson. Over the years, as it became tougher and tougher to raid the larger towns, most of the men who rode with him in the beginning dropped off to go back to farming. Only his brother Doc remained from the original gang. The others were saddle tramps and thieves who needed a leader to direct them. Yeah, the glory days were gone now as law enforcement became stronger and reached farther. His gang had been reduced to 5 trigger-happy degenerates who'd put a knife in their mother's backs if it showed a profit. Mace emerged from the trees and walked back to the fire.
What the hell? There might be something worth taking in that town tomorrow. If there ain't, I'll burn it to the ground.
Standing on a rise in the southwest corner of his cornfield, looking through a gap in the trees, Oscar Perkins had a clear view of the south road into Paradise, some 100 yards distant. It was mere coincidence that he happened to be standing on that particular spot on this cloudy morning when 6 riders, 3 of them leading pack horses, passed on their way to town. He gazed at them for as long as they remained in view, unable to identify him at that distance. It was unusual to see that many men riding together unless it was some of Pryor's crew, and that was unlikely on this side of town. He wondered, since he was officially the sheriff, if there was any reason for him to go into town to see what their business was in Paradise. His deputy Tom had told him of 2 strangers that passed through the town the day before. He said they didn't stop, just rode up and down the street and then left. Oscar had considered that kind of odd, but he saw no reason to get concerned about it.
I can't go running off to town every time a stranger rides in. I've got a farm to work. Besides, Tom can take care of it if anything needs taken care of.
Raymond Pryor had been understanding on the matter of Oscar's farm. He permitted Oscar to work as more a part-time sheriff and made young Tom Austin a deputy. That kept the town covered since Tom was there all the time working in the stables. Oscar had no real qualifications for the job as sheriff other than being a sizable man. But it was an opportunity to enjoy a small salary, so he took the job. It seldom required much of him, since all the folks in Paradise were law-abiding citizens.
Looks more like they're just passing through. Just travelers. Most likely heading up Montana way looking for the gold fields.
With the passing of the hindmost horse's rear end around the bend in the road, disappearing from his view, he dismissed the incident and returned to his work. The wagon track that served as Paradise's main street was not wide enough for 6 men on horses to ride abreast. Consequently, Mace's gang of outlaws rode into town in columns of 2s like a small military expedition. As Doc and Lacey had done the day before, they rode the short length of the street before turning around and heading for the saloon. Mace paid close attention to the sheriff's office, noting that it appeared to be empty. Joe Galt paused to look at the strangers as they ambled past his forge. He nodded, but none of the 6 bothered to acknowledge his greeting. Concerned eyes watched the wild-looking group from other storefronts. When Fred Hatfield crossed the street from his general store to the saloon, he found the 6 strangers already seated around the 2 back tables. Gus Hopkins immediately answered Hatfield's questioning look.
I don't know who they are. They ain't had time to say much of anything except to order some whiskey.
They're a right rough-looking bunch,
and from the appearance of their horses, it looks like they've been doing some hard riding.
Are you drinking?
Yeah, I reckon. Wouldn't hurt to pour me a little one. You ain't heard nothing about Pryor hiring on more men, have you? Though they don't hardly look like the kind of men he hires.
I expect they're just passing through. I reckon you could ask them.
I reckon I could do that.
He tossed back his drink and set the empty glass on the bar.
Might as well be neighborly.
Hatfield approached the two tables, and all six men turned to stare at him.
How you fellers doing?
Lacey Jenkins curled his lip.
Who the hell wants to know? You the sheriff or something?
No, sir. No, indeed. I'm Fred Hatfield. I own the general store next door. I just never remembered seeing you boys in town before. I just thought maybe you was some new men Mr. Pryor might have hired. I was just aiming to be neighborly.
Bob Dawson looked the storekeeper over.
Well, I'm somewhere else.
Studying the flustered merchant with some amusement, Mace Cantrell held up his hand.
Hold on here a minute, boys. Like the man says, he's just trying to be neighborly.
Cantrell fixed his gaze upon Hatfield.
Who's Mr. Pryor? Is he the sheriff?
Hatfield felt a tiny bit more at ease, since the man obviously enjoyed control over his companions.
Oh, no, sir. Oscar Perkins is the sheriff. Mr. Pryor is half or full owner of every business here in Paradise. You might say he owns the town.
Owns the town, huh? So he's the stud horse around here, is he? He must be a right wealthy man.
Hatfield glanced nervously at Gus, who was silently shaking his head in an effort to warn him that he might be telling the strangers more than Pryor would have him know.
I don't know. Enough to get by, I reckon.
Seeing Hatfield about to clam up on him, Mace broke out a generous smile and attempted to put the nervous storekeeper at ease.
As a matter of fact, Pryor might just be the man we came to town to see. Where do you suppose we might find him?
While the rest of his gang exchanged puzzled glances, Mace shoved an empty chair out with his foot.
Well, set yourself down and have a drink, Hatfield. I expect we'll be doing a fair amount of business at your store.
Feeling a little less intimidated and encouraged by the possibility of some business coming his way, Hatfield pulled the chair clear of the table and sat down. Eager to see where his brother was going with this charade, Doc grabbed the bottle and poured the store owner a stiff one.
Thank you, sir.
Hatfield started to raise the glass. He paused when he realized that he was holding the attention of six blank faces, obviously awaiting his answer to the question that had been posed by Mace.
Oh, Mr. Pryor don't stay here in town very much. I suppose you'll have to go out to his ranch to see him.
Mace nodded his head thoughtfully as he considered that fact.
Well, he don't come in on a regular basis?
Hatfield shook his head.
Where's the sheriff? It didn't look like there was nobody in his office when we rode in.
Oscar?
Yeah, old Oscar. Is he hanging around here somewhere?
Hatfield tossed back his whiskey.
Oscar don't hang around much in town unless there's some kind of trouble or something. We don't have much trouble here in Paradise, so he spends most of his time working his farm.
Is that a fact? So what you're saying is if a gang of outlaws rode into town right now, they could pretty much take the whole damn town if they were of a mind to.
No, sir. We ain't without law. Oscar's deputy, Tom Austin, is always here in town. He'd take care of any trouble that got started.
Mace was beginning to get the general picture of Paradise, and he liked what he saw. This isolated little town they'd stumbled onto just might be a potential gold mine, and the change of luck he sorely needed. Like a plump, juicy plum, Paradise was there for the picking.
I'd best get back to my store before Lena comes to haul me out by the ankles.
We'll be in to see you pretty soon.
Doc leaned in.
What you got on your mind? You thinking about hitting that man's store?
Yeah, hell no. I'm thinking about hitting the whole damn town.
He met with a cluster of puzzled faces.
I'll tell you what the deal is outside. Let's get... Oh, still a minute.
Mace watched a slight man with gray hair walk up to the bar.
Hello, Mr. Pryor.
When Lacey saw Mace fish in his pocket for money, he was surprised. Mace seemed intent on paying, and he'd assumed they'd simply take the whiskey and anything the bartender had in the till. That was the way they usually left a place they didn't intend to see again. Mace saw the gray-haired man glance his way several times.
You boys head to the horses. I'll settle up.
Cantrell got up and walked over to the bar.
I reckon I'd best settle up for the whiskey my men drank.
He fashioned a friendly smile for the man who'd been talking to Gus and nodded.
You wouldn't by any chance be Mr. Pryor, would you?
Yes, I'm Raymond Pryor.
Mace was sharp enough to sense the man's hesitation, and he had to surmise Gus told him the strangers were asking about him. From the look on Pryor's face, Mace could also surmise he had no interest in talking. Amused by the thought, Mace smiled again. He cast a sideways glance in Gus's direction.
Well, Gus here was probably about to tell you that I was planning to come see you.
Is that right? What about?
Pryor was a fair appraiser of people, and he spotted Mace Cantrell as someone with whom he would have no reason to discuss anything.
My name's Mace Cantrell. Maybe you heard of me?
He paused to watch Pryor's reaction. He saw no indication that the name meant anything to Pryor, good or bad.
Me and my men work for the territorial governor as a special posse. We was just passing through your little town here on our way back east from a job with the marshal over in Helena.
You kind of got a little off course if you wound up here in Paradise.
Well, some of the boys wanted to see a little bit of the country between here and the Missouri. So we left the Yellowstone and headed north. When I heard somebody was building a town up here, I wanted to stop by and let you know we were passing through in case you needed our help with anything.
Well, Mr. Cantrell, was it? I think Paradise is peaceful enough, so we don't need your services right now. But thanks for stopping by.
No trouble at all. It was a pleasure meeting you.
Cantrell picked up his change from the bar and nodded a pleasant farewell to Gus.
I reckon we'll be on our way.
They nodded in response to his goodbye and said nothing until he was out the door.
Well, ain't he something?
He's something, all right. Bunch of drifters. I never heard of any special posse. I don't know what he's really selling, but we don't need any of it.
Outside, Mace approached the hitching rail where the others were waiting on their horses.
Boys, we may have just been lucky enough to run up on the sweetest deal we'll ever see again.
The other five looked at him with open faces. Their reaction seemed to please him even more.
Look around you. What do you see?
Don't see much of nothing.
That's right, you don't. And that's the reason I'm the leader of this gang, is I see a goddamn gold mine. We'll know for sure after we see what kind of men this Pryor feller's got riding for him.
Hell, Mace, this place don't look no different from 100 other little settlements trying to start up. There usually ain't a dollar's worth of salt in the whole damn town.
When we get through with it, there won't be a penny's worth. Think about what the feller Hatfield just said. Pryor's got the money to set all these folks up in business. And he's holding the prices down. When's the last time you bought a shot of good whiskey for 2 bits? He's out to build himself a town, backing everybody with his own money.
He'll get his town built up, and when he does, he'll own every damn soul in it.
If Pryor's the man holding the money, why the hell don't we just go take it and get on back to the Dakotas?
I expect that's what we'll do. But first, we'll have to find out where he keeps it, won't we? There ain't no bank here, so he's got to hit somewhere at his ranch. We'll ride on out of town like we're done with it, so the good folks don't worry about us.
What about the sheriff and his deputy?
I ain't worried about no farmer that works part-time as a sheriff. If you wasn't so damn dumb, you could see that like the storekeeper said. They ain't never had no trouble in Paradise, so they don't think they need a real sheriff. This feller Pryor is trying to build a Bible-thumping little town that don't bother nobody, and far enough in the hills that nobody's likely to bother them. Now, I may be wrong. If I am, I'll be the first to admit it. But I've just been talking to Mr. Pryor, and he ain't got no starch in him at all. And I'm betting the men he hired ain't neither. Yeah.
Come on, we're leaving town.
They rode past the sheriff's office at the end of the street, where there was still no sign of any activity. Unnoticed by the band of outlaws, young Tom Austin stood watching at the edge of the stables next door, undecided as to whether or not he should approach the six riders. Hesitating until it was too late, he questioned whether his responsibility as deputy sheriff was to know everybody's business in town just because they were strangers. When he was sure they could no longer be seen, Mace pulled the gang up.
Junior, go back and watch out for Pryor.
Right.
It was not a long wait. Junior came back to meet him in the tree.
Gray-headed fella. He came out of the saloon and went in the store next door. Went in there 5 minutes when he come out again and headed north out of town.
All right, keep on his tail. And damn it, make sure he don't see you. We'll circle around these hills and come on behind you as soon as we get clear of town. I don't want nobody to see us following him.
Raymond Pryor looked up from his desk. Gazing out the window, he paused to puzzle over the group of riders crossing the stream, apparently headed toward the house. Unable to identify any of them at first, he then recognized the stranger who had approached him in the saloon.
Mace somebody.
Pryor could think of no business he wished to discuss with the likes of that man and his crew. He remained seated at his desk, knowing he was not likely to be spared the meeting. In a few minutes, Juanita entered the room.
Señor Pryor, some men are coming toward the house.
I know, Juanita. I saw them.
Do you want me to make some coffee?
No, hell no. I don't want them in the house. They won't be here long.
When he walked out the front door, it was to find Mace and his five companions dismounted and already lolling about on the porch. The man who had approached him in the saloon was comfortable in the rocking chair.
Is there something I can do for you, Mr.
Cantrell. Mace Cantrell.